Drumfire had felt the shore shelving under his hoofs and lunged forward powerfully. By now Jim had recovered his breath and coughed most of the water out of his lungs. He threw one leg over the stallion's back. As soon as he was astride, he reached down and pulled Louisa up behind him. She wrapped both arms around his waist and hung on with all her strength. Drumfire burst out of the shallows, water exploding before his charge, and then they were out on the beach. Jim saw Colonel Kayser galloping to intercept them and urged Drumfire into full stride, swinging his head away until Kayser was trailing 20 strides behind. "Wach, you donder! Wait! She has an escaped prisoner! Hand the cow over to the law!" "I will deliver her to the castle myself," Jim yelled without looking back. "No, no, you don't! She's mine! Bring the bitch back!" Kayser's voice was thick with fury. As Jim urged Drumfire on down the beach, he was determined on one thing only. He had already chanced too much ever to turn this girl over to anyone in the garrison, and in particular to Kayser. He had watched too many of the floggings and executions on the parade ground outside the castle walls over which Kayser had presided. Jim's own great-grandfather had been tortured and executed on that very ground after being falsely convicted of piracy on the high seas. "They aren't going to get this one," he swore grimly. Her thin arms were clasped round his waist, and he could feel the length of her body pressed against his naked back. Although she was half-starved, wet and shivering with the cold of the green waters and the wind of Drumfire's speed, he could sense the courage and determination in her, which matched his own. "She's a fighter, this one. I can never let her down," he thought, and called back to her, "Hold tight, Louisa, we're going to run the fat colonel into the dirt." Though she did not answer, and he could hear her teeth chattering, she tightened her grip around him and crouched low. He could feel by her balance and the way she adjusted to Drumfire's motion that she was a horsewoman. He glanced back under his arm and saw that they had opened the gap on Kayser. Jim had raced against Trofart before, and he knew the mare's best points and her weaknesses. She was quick and game, as her name, Trueheart, suggested, but Kayser overburdened her light frame. On firm, smooth going, she was in her element, and she probably had the legs of Drumfire out in the open. But on this soft beach sand, or over rock and other heavy going, Drumfire's great strength gave him the advantage. Although the stallion was carrying a double load, Louisa was light as a sparrow, and Jim was not as heavily built as the colonel. Yet Jim knew better than to underestimate the mare. He knew she had the heart of a lioness, and had almost run Drumfire down over the last half mile of the Christmas racing. "I must pick the course to our advantage," he decided. He had ridden every inch of the ground between here and the foothills, and knew every hill and marsh, salt pan and patch of forest where Trueheart would be at a disadvantage. "Stop, young'un, or I will shoot!" There was another shout behind, and when Jim looked back, Kayser had drawn the pistol from the holster on the front of his saddle and was leaning out to avoid hitting his own horse. In that swift glance, Jim saw that it was a single-barreled weapon, and there was not a second in the holster. Jim swerved Drumfire to the left without a break in his stride, cutting sharply across the mare's nose. In an instant he had changed Kayser's target from a steady, going-away shot to one with a sharp angle of deflection. Even an experienced soldier like the colonel, shooting from a galloping horse, would have difficulty judging the forward allowance. Jim reached back, seized Louisa around the waist, and swung her round on his off side, tucking her under his armpit and shielding her with his own body. The pistol shot boomed out, and he felt the strike of the heavy ball. It was high in his back across his shoulders, but after the numbing shock his arms were still strong and his senses alert. He knew he was not badly wounded. "Only pricked me," he thought, and then he spoke. "That's his one and only shot," he said to encourage Louisa, and swung her back into her place behind him. "Mercy, you're hit," she exclaimed fearfully. Blood was streaming down his back. "We'll worry about that later," he sang out. "Now Drumfire and I are going to show you a few of our tricks." He was enjoying himself. He had just been half drowned and shot, but he was still cocky. Louisa had found herself an indomitable champion, and her spirit soared. But they had lost ground with that evasive turn, and close behind they heard Trueheart's hooves slapping into the sand and the scraping of steel in the scabbard as Kieser drew his sabre. Louisa glanced back and saw him rise up over her, standing in the stirrups with his blade held high. But the change of his balance wrong-footed the mare, and she stumbled. Kieser swayed and grabbed at the pommel of his saddle to regain balance, and Drumfire pulled ahead. Jim put him at the slope of the high dune, and here the stallion's great strength came into play. He went up in a series of violent lunges, with the sand spurting out from under his hoofs. Trueheart dropped back sharply as she carried the colonel's weight up the slope. They went over the top and slid down the far side. From the foot of the dune there was open ground and firm going to the edge of the lagoon. Louisa looked back. "They are gaining again," she warned Jim. Trueheart was striding out gracefully. Even though she was carrying the weight of the colonel and all his weapons and accoutrements, she seemed to flirt with the earth. "He's reloading his pistol." There was an edge of alarm in her voice. Kieser was ramming a ball into the muzzle. "Let's see if we can wet his powder for him," Jim said, and they reached the edge of the lagoon and plunged in without a check. "Swim again," Jim ordered, and Louisa slipped into the water on Drumfire's other flank. They both looked back as Trueheart reached the edge of the lagoon and Kieser pulled her up. He jumped down and primed the pan of his pistol. Then he cocked the hammer and aimed at them across the open water. There was a puff of white gun smoke. A fountain of water jumped from the surface an arm's length behind them, and with a hum the heavy ball ricocheted over their heads. "Now throw your boots at us," Jim laughed, and Kieser stamped with rage. Jim hoped that he would give up now. Surely, even in his anger, he must consider the fact that Trueheart was so heavily burdened, while they were almost naked and Drumfire's back was bare. Kieser made the decision and swung up onto the mare's back. He pushed her into the water just as Drumfire emerged onto the muddy bank on the far side. Immediately, Jim turned him parallel to the shore and, keeping to the soft ground, led him along the shore at a trot. "We must give Drumfire a chance to breathe," he told Louisa, as she ran behind him. "That swim out to the ship would have drowned any other horse." He was watching their pursuers. Trueheart was only halfway across the lagoon. Kieser wasted time with his pistol practice. "One thing is certain. There'll be no more of that. His powder is well and truly soaked by now." "The water washed the blood from your wound," she told him, reaching out to touch his back lightly. "I can see now it's a graze. Not deep, thank the good Lord." "It's you we have to worry about," he said. "Your skin and bones, not a pound of meat on you. How long can you run on those skinny legs?" "As long as you can," she flared at him, and angry red spots appeared on her pale cheeks. He grinned at her unrepentantly. "You may have to prove that boast before this day is done. Kayser is across." Far behind them, Trueheart came onto the bank, and streaming water from his tunic, breeches and boots, Kayser mounted her and set out along the bank after them. He urged the mare into a gallop, but heavy clods of mud flew from her hoofs, and it was immediately obvious that she was making heavy work of it. Jim had kept to the mud flats for just that reason, to test Trueheart's strength. "Up you get!" Jim seized Louisa, threw her up onto the stallion's back and broke into a run. He kept a firm grip on Drumfire's mane, so he was pulled along, keeping pace with the horse's easy canter while saving the animal's strength. He kept glancing back to judge their relative speeds. He could afford to let Kayser gain a little ground now. Carrying only Louisa's weight, Drumfire was going easily, while the mare was burning up her strength in this reckless pursuit. Within half a mile, Kayser's weight began to tell, and Trueheart slowed to a walk. She was still trailing by half a pistol shot. Jim slowed to her speed to keep the gap constant. "Come down, if you please, your ladyship," he told Louisa. "Give Drumfire another breather." She jumped down lightly, but flashed at him. "Don't call me that." It was a bitter reminder of the taunts she had endured from her fellow convicts. "Perhaps we should rather call you Hedgehog," he asked. "The Lord knows you have prickles enough to warrant it." Kayser must be almost exhausted by now, Jim thought, for he stayed in the saddle, not taking his weight off his mount. "They're almost done in," he told Louisa. He knew that not far ahead, and still on the Courtney estate, lay a salt pan that they called Grootwit, Big White. That was where he was leading Kayser. "He's coming on again," Louisa warned him, and he saw that Kayser was pushing the mare into a canter. She was a game little filly, and she was responding to the whip. "Mount," he ordered. "I can run as far as you can." She shook the salt-crusted tangle of her long hair at him defiantly. "In Jesus' name, woman, must you always argue? Must you always blaspheme?" she riposted. But she allowed him to hoist her onto the stallion's back. They ran on. Within the mile, Trueheart had slowed to a walk, and they could do the same. "There's the beginning of the salt," Jim pointed ahead, and even under the low storm clouds and in the gathering dusk, it shone like a vast mirror. "It looks flat and hard." She shaded her eyes against the glare. "It looks that way, but under the crust it's porridge. With the great fat Dutchman and all his equipment up on her back, the mare will break through every few paces. It's almost 3 miles across the pan. They will be completely finished before they reach the other side. And," he looked at the sky, "by then it will be dark." Although it was hidden by the lowering blanket of cloud, the sun must have been close to the horizon, and the darkness was coming on. As Jim led Drumfire, the girl staggering beside him off the treacherous white plain. He paused at the edge of the forest, and they both looked back. Like a long string of black pearls, Drumfire's hoofprints were deeply scored into the smooth white surface. Even for him, the crossing had been a terrible ordeal. Far behind, they could just make out the small, dark shape of the mare. 2 hours earlier, with Kayser on her back, Trueheart had broken through the salt crust and into the quicksand beneath. Jim had stopped and watched Kayser struggle to free her. He had been tempted to turn back and help them. She was such a game, beautiful animal, and he could not bear to watch her bogged down and exhausted. Then he remembered that he was unarmed and almost naked, while Kayser had his sabre and was a swordsman to be reckoned with. Jim had watched him leading his cavalry troop through their evolutions on the parade ground outside the castle. While he hesitated, Kayser had managed by force to drag the mare free of the mud and continue plodding in pursuit. Now he was still following, and Jim frowned. If there were ever a time to meet Kayser, it would be when he comes off the salt. He would be exhausted, and in the dark I would have the benefit of surprise. But he has his sabre, and I have nothing, he murmured. Louisa looked at him for a moment, then turned her back to him modestly and reached under the skirt of her shift. She found the horn-handled clasp-knife in the pouch she wore strapped around her waist and handed it to him without a word. He stared at it in astonishment, then burst out laughing as he recognized it. "I withdraw everything I said about you. You look like a Viking maid, and, bejesus, you act like one, too. Watch your blaspheming tongue, Jim Courtney," she said. But there was no fire in the rebuke. She was too tired to argue further, and the compliment had been a pretty one. As she turned away her head, there was a weary half-smile on her lips. Jim led Drumfire into the trees, and she followed them. After a few hundred paces, in a spot where the forest was thickest, he tethered the stallion and told Louisa, "Now you can rest a while." This time she did not protest, but sank down on the thick leaf mould on the forest floor, curled up, closed her eyes. In her weakened state she felt that she might never have the strength to stand up again. Hardly had the thought flashed through her mind than she was asleep. Jim wasted a few moments admiring her suddenly serene features. Until then he had not realized how young she was. Now she looked like a sleeping child. While he watched her, he opened the blade of the knife and tested the point on the ball of his thumb. At last he tore himself away and ran back to the edge of the forest. Keeping well hidden, he peered out across the darkening salt pan. Kayser was still coming on doggedly, leading the mare. "Will he never give up?" Jim wondered, and felt a twinge of admiration for him. Then he looked around for the best place to hide beside the tracks that Drumfire had left. He picked a patch of dense bush, crept into it, and squatted there with the knife in his hand. Kayser reached the edge of the pan and staggered out onto the firm footing. By this time it was so dark that although Jim could hear him panting for breath, he was just a dark shape. He came on slowly, leading the mare, and Jim let him pass his hiding place. Then he slipped out of the bush and crept up behind him. Any sound he might have made was covered by the hoof-falls of the mare. From behind he locked his left arm around Caser's throat and at the same time pressed the point of the knife into the soft skin under his ear. "I will kill you if you force me to," he snarled, making his tone ferocious. Caser froze with shock. Then he regained his own voice. "You can't hope to get away with this, Courtney. There's no place for you to run. Give me the woman, and I will settle things with your father and Governor van der Witten." Jim reached down and drew the sabre from the scabbard on the colonel's belt. Then he released his lock around the man's throat and stepped back. But he held the point of the sabre to Kayser's chest. "Take off your clothes," he ordered. "You are young and stupid, Courtney," Kayser replied coldly. "I will try to make allowances for that." "Tunic first," Jim ordered. "Then breeches and boots." Caser did not move. Jim pricked his chest, and at last, reluctantly, the colonel reached up and began to unbutton his tunic. "What do you hope to achieve?" he asked, as he shrugged out of it. "Is this some boyish notion of chivalry? The woman is a convicted felon. She is probably a whore and a murderess." "Say that again, colonel, and I'll spit you like a sucking pig." This time, Jim drew blood with the point. Caser sat down to pull off his boots and his breeches. Jim stuffed them into Trueheart's saddlebags. Then, with the point of the sabre at the man's back, he escorted Caser, barefoot and wearing only his undershirt, to the edge of the salt pan. "Follow your own tracks, Colonel," he told him, "and you should be back at the castle in time for breakfast." "Listen to me, young'un," Caser said in a thin, tight voice. "I will come after you. I will see you hanged on the parade, and I promise you it will be slow, very slow." "If you stand here talking, Colonel, you're going to miss your breakfast," Jim smiled at him. "You'd far better start walking." He watched Caser trudge away across the salt pan. Suddenly the heavy clouds were stripped away by the wind, and the full moon burst through to light the pale surface as though it were day. It was bright enough to throw a shadow at Caser's feet. Jim watched him until he was only a dark blob in the distance and knew that he was not coming back. Not tonight, at least. "But it's not the last we've seen of the gallant colonel," he thought. "We can be sure of that." Then he ran back to Trueheart and led her into the forest. He shook Louisa awake. "Wake up, Hedgehog. We have a long journey ahead of us," he told her. "And by this time tomorrow we are going to have Caser and a squadron of cavalry in full cry after us." When she sat up groggily, he went to Trueheart. A rolled woolen cavalry cloak was strapped on top of Caser's saddlebags. "It will be cold when we get into the mountains," he warned her. She was still half asleep and did not protest as he wrapped the cloak around her shoulders. Then he found the colonel's food bag. It held a loaf of bread, a wedge of cheese, a few apples, and a flask of wine. The colonel dearly loves his food. He tossed her an apple, and she wolfed it down, core and all. "Sweeter than honey," she said through a mouthful. "I never tasted anything like it before." "Greedy little hedgehog," he teased her, and this time she gave him an urchin smile. Most people found it hard to be angry with Jim for long. He squatted on his haunches in front of her, and with the clasp knife cut a hunk of bread and slapped a thick slice of cheese on top of it. She ate with ferocious intensity. He watched her pale face in the moonlight. She looked like a pixie. "Aren't you?" she asked. "Aren't you eating?" He shook his head. He decided that there would not be enough for both of them. This girl was starving. "How did you learn to speak such good English?" "My mother came from Devon." "My oath! That's where we're from. My great-great-grandfather was a duke or something of that ilk." "So, shall I call you duke?" "That will do until I think of something better, hedgehog." She took another bite of bread and cheese, so she could not reply. While she ate, he sorted through the rest of Caser's possessions. He tried on the gold frog tunic and held the lapels together. "Space for two of us in here, but it's warm." The front flaps of the colonel's breeches went halfway again around Jim's middle, but he belted them with one of the straps from the saddlebags. Then he tried the boots. At least these are a good fit. In London, I saw a play called The Tin Soldier, she said. That's who you look like now. You were in London? Despite himself, he was impressed. London was the centre of the world. You must tell me about it as soon as we have an opportunity. Then he led the horses to the well on the edge of the pan where the cattle were watered. He and Mansur had dug it themselves 2 years ago. The water in it was sweet, and the horses drank thirstily. When he led them back, he found Louisa had fallen asleep again under the cloak. He squatted beside her and studied her face in the moonlight, and there was a strange hollow feeling under his ribs. He left her to sleep a little longer and went to feed the horses from the colonel's grain bag. Then he selected what he needed from Kayser's equipment. The pistol was a lovely weapon, and tucked into the leather holster was a small canvas roll that contained the ramrod and all the accessories. The sabre was of the finest steel. In the tunic he found a gold watch and a purse filled with silver guilders and a few gold ducats. In the back pocket there was a small brass box that contained a flint and steel and cotton kindling. "If I steal his horse, I might as well take the money too," he told himself. However, he drew the line at filching Kayser's more personal possessions, so he placed the gold watch and the medals in one of the saddlebags and left it lying conspicuously in the centre of the clearing. He knew that Kayser would return here tomorrow with his bushman trackers and would find his personal treasures. "I wonder how grateful he will be for my generosity," he smiled bleakly. He was carried along by a sense of reckless inevitability. He knew that there was no turning back. He was committed. He went to resaddle Trueheart, then squatted beside Louisa. She was curled into a ball under the cloak. He stroked her hair to wake her gently. She opened her eyes and looked up at him. "Don't touch me like that," she whispered. "Don't ever touch me like that again." Her voice was filled with such bitter loathing that he recoiled. Years ago, Jim had captured a wildcat kitten. Despite all his loving patience, he had never been able to tame the creature. It snarled and bit and scratched. In the end, he had taken it out into the veld and set it free. Perhaps this girl was like that. "I had to wake you," he said. "We must go on." She stood up immediately. "Take the mare," he said. "She has a soft mouth and a gentle nature, yet she is as fast as the wind. Her name is Trueheart." He boosted her into the saddle, and she took the reins and wrapped the cloak tightly around her shoulders. He handed her the last of the bread and cheese. "You can eat as we go." She ate as though she was still famished, and he wondered what terrible privations she had been forced to endure that had turned her into the starved, abused wild creature. He felt a fleeting doubt at his own ability to help or redeem her. He thrust it aside and smiled at her in what he imagined was a placatory way, but which to her seemed merely supercilious. "When we get to Majuba, Zama will have the hunter's pot going. I hope he's filled it to the brim. I'd place money on you in an eating contest with the good colonel." He sprang up on Drumfire's back. "First, though, we have something else to do here." He set off at a trot in the direction of High Weald, but he circled well clear of the homestead. By now it was after midnight, but still he did not want to chance running into his father or Uncle Dorian. The news of his escapade would have reached their ears almost as soon as he had plucked the girl out of the sea. He had seen many of the family, freed slaves and servants among the spectators on the beach. He could not face his father now. "We'll get no sympathy there," he thought. "He'll try to force me to turn Louisa over to the colonel." He rode instead to a cluster of huts at the east side of the paddock. He dismounted in a stand of trees and handed Drumfire's reins to Louisa. "Stay here. I won't be long." He approached the largest mud-walled hut in the village carefully and whistled. There was a long pause. Then a lantern flared behind the uncured sheepskin that covered the single window in place of a curtain. The reeking fleece was drawn aside, and a dark head poked out suspiciously. "Who's there?"
"Bakat, it's me." "Somoya."
He came out into the moonlight with a greasy blanket tucked around his waist. He was as tiny as a child, his skin amber in the moonlight. His features were flattened and his eyes had a curious Asiatic slant. He was a bushman, and he could track a lost beast for 50 leagues over desert and mountain through blizzard and storm. He smiled up at Jim, and his eyes were almost hidden in a web of wrinkles.
May the Kulu Kulu smile upon you, Somoya.
And on you also, old friend. Call out all the other shepherds. Gather up the herds and drive them over every road, especially all the paths heading towards the east and north. I want them to chop up the ground until it looks like a ploughed field. Nobody must be able to follow my tracks when I leave here, not even you. Do you understand?
Bakat cackled with laughter.
Oh, yeah, Somoya. I understand very well. We all saw the fat soldier chasing you when you ran off with that pretty little girl. Don't worry, by morning there won't be a single one of your tracks left for him to follow.
Good fellow, Jim clapped him on the back. I'm off.
I know where you are going. You are taking the Robber's Road, huh?
The Robber's Road was the legendary escape route out of the colony, travelled only by fugitives and outlaws. Nobody knows where it leads because nobody ever comes back. The spirits of my ancestors whisper to me in the night, and my soul pines for their wild places. Do you have a place for me at your side?
Jim laughed.
Follow and be welcome, Bakat. I know that you'll be able to find me wherever I go. You could follow the tracks of a ghost over the burning rocks of hell, but first do what you must do here. Tell my father I am well. Tell my mother I love her, he said, and ran back to where Louisa and the horses were still waiting. They went on. The storm had blown itself out. The wind had dropped, and the moon was low in the west before they reached the foothills. He stopped beside a stream that ran down from the hills. "We'll rest and water the horses," he told her. He did not offer to help her dismount, but she dropped to the ground as lithely as a cat and took True Heart to drink at the pool. She and the mare seemed already to have established an accord. Then she went into the bushes on her own. He wanted to call after her and warn her not to go far, but he held back the words. The colonel's wine flask was half empty. Jim smiled as he shook it. Kesar must have been nipping at it since breakfast time yesterday, he thought, and went to the pool to dilute what remained with the sweet mountain water. He heard the girl come back through the bushes, and still hidden from him by a pile of tall rocks, go down to the water. There was a splash. Damn me, if the madwoman's not taking a bath! He shook his head and shivered at the thought. There was still snow on the mountains, and the night air was chill. When Louisa returned, she sat on one of the rocks at the edge of the pool, not too close to him, nor again too far away. Her hair was wet, and she combed it out. He recognized the tortoise-shell comb. He went over to her and passed her the wine flask. She paused long enough to drink from it.
"Oh, that's good,"
she said it like a peace offering, then went on combing the pale hair that reached almost to her waist. He watched her quietly, but she did not look in his direction again. A fishing owl darted down to the pool on silent wings, like a gigantic moth. Hunting only by the last rays of the moon, it snatched a small yellowfish from the waters and flew with it to a branch of the dead tree on the far bank. The fish flapped in its talons as the owl tore chunks of meat out of its back. Louisa looked away. When she spoke again, her voice was soft and the faint accent appealing.
"Don't think I'm not grateful for what you have done for me. I know you have risked your life and maybe more than that to help me."
"Well, you must understand that I keep a menagerie of pets," he spoke lightly. "I needed only one more to add to it.
A small hedgehog."
"Perhaps you have the right to call me that," she said, and sipped from the flask again.
"You know nothing about me. Things have happened to me, things that you could never understand."
"I know a little about you. I have seen your courage and your determination. I saw what it was like, and how it smelt on board the Mew. Perhaps I might understand," he replied. "At least I would try." He turned to her, then felt his heart break as he saw the tears running down her cheeks, silver in the moonlight. He wanted to rush to her and hold her tightly, but he remembered what she had said. "Never touch me like that again." Instead, he said, "Whether you like it or not, I'm your friend. I want to understand." She wiped her cheeks with the palm of one small dainty hand and sat huddled, thin, pale, and disconsolate in the cloak. "There's just one thing I must know," Jim said. "I have a cousin called Mansur. He is closer to me than a brother could be. He said that perhaps you are a murderess. That burns my soul. I must know. Are you? Is that why you were on the Mew?" She turned slowly towards him and with both hands parted the curtain of her damp hair so that he could see her face. "My father and mother died of the plague. I dug their graves with my own hands. I swear to you, Jim Courtney, on my love for them and on the graves in which they lie, that I am no murderess." He heaved a great sigh of relief. "Ha, I believe you. You don't have to tell me anything else." She drank again from the flask, then handed it back to him. "Don't let me have more. It softens my heart when I need to be strong," she said. They sat on in silence. He was just about to tell her that they must go on deeper into the mountains, when she whispered, so quietly that he was not sure that she had spoken, "There was a man, a rich and powerful man whom I trusted as once I trusted my dead father. He did things to me that he did not want other people to know about." "No, Louisa," he held up his hand to stop her, "don't tell me this. I owe you my life and my freedom. You have a right to know. Please stop." He wanted to jump to his feet and run into the bushes to escape her words, but he could not move. He was held mesmerized by them, as a mouse by the swaying dance of the cobra. She went on in the same sweet, childlike tones. "I will not tell you what he did to me. I will never tell anyone that. But I cannot let any man touch me again. When I tried to escape from him, he had his servants hide a packet of jewelry in my room. Then they called the watch to find it. They took me before the magistrate in Amsterdam. My accuser was not even in the courtroom when I was condemned to be transported for life." They were both silent for a long time. Then she spoke again. "Now you know about me, Jim Courtney. Now you know that I am a soiled and discarded plaything. What do you want to do now?" "I want to kill him," said Jim at last. "If ever I meet this man, I will kill him." "I have spoken honestly to you. Now you must speak honestly to me. Be sure of what you want. I have told you that I will let no man touch me again. I have told you what I am. Do you want to take me back to Good Hope and hand me over to Colonel Kaiser? If you do, I am ready to go back with you." He did not want her to see his face. Not since he was a child had anyone seen him weep. He jumped to his feet and went to saddle Trueheart. "Come, Hedgehog. It's a long ride to Majuba. We have no more time to waste in idle chatter." She came to him obediently and mounted the horse. He led her into the deep defile in the mountains and up the steep gorge. It grew colder as they climbed, and in the dawn the sun lit the mountain tops with a weird pink light. Patches of old, unmelted snow gleamed among the rocks. It was late in the morning before they paused on the crest at the limit of the tree line and looked down into the hidden valley. There was a tumble-down building among the rocks of the scree slope. She might not have noticed it were it not for the thin column of smoke rising from the hole in the tattered thatch roof and the small herd of mules in the stone-walled kraal. "Majuba," he told her, as he reined in. "The place of the doves. And that is Zama." A tall young man, dressed in a loincloth, had come out into the sunlight and was staring up at them. "We've been together all our lives. I think you'll like him." Zama waved and bounded up the slope to meet them. Jim slipped down from Drumfire's back to greet him.
"Have you got the coffee pot on?" he asked.
Zama looked up at the girl on the horse.
They studied each other for a moment. He was tall and well-formed, with a broad, strong face and very white teeth.
"I see you, Miss Louisa," he said at last.
"I see you also, Zama. But how did you know my name?"
"Samoya told me." "How did you know mine?"
"He told me also. He is a great chatterbox, is he not?" she said,
and they laughed together.
"But why do you call him Samoya?" she asked.
"It is the name my father gave him. It means the wild wind," Zama replied. "He blows as he pleases, like the wind."
"Which way will he blow now?" she asked.
But she was looking at Jim with a small, quizzical smile.
"Ha ha! We shall see," Zama laughed.
"But it will be the way we least expect."